Good morning, everyone. Welcome to this week's edition of the Mad Tech Podcast. After a couple of weeks there in Singapore, we're back in the office here in London, which is a nice little change of scenery. However, I'm welcoming our special guests to the podcast this morning, who was a face that we saw quite a bit of in Singapore, Jonas Janamadji from IAB Australia and Tech Lab. Hello, JJ.
Hello, welcome. It's lovely to be here.
Yep, we're delighted to have
you. Exchange Wire Towers.
Yes, I'm glad to finally get some get you visiting Exchange Wire Towers, making you walk up the four flights of stairs.
Yep, I was disappointed by the level of security that you've got, though, because downstairs there are metal doors. I was expecting people with shotguns. I just walked straight in.
Yeah, I think the difference is...
About? It's a mad Irishman here.
I was going to say, I think the difference is...
IRA Central.
You've got the
shotgun. The units downstairs have got diamonds to protect. We just have ad tech. Worth protecting, of course. And, of course, now almost like a special guest on the podcast, we also have Kieran O'Kane, CEO of Exchange Wire. Hi, Kieran.
Good morning.
It's been a while since we've had you in the hot
seat. Yes, I'm delighted to be here with JJ.
You were ejected for bad behaviour before in the past.
I have not been ejected for anything.
So does the same thing happen between you two as does on stage, where Kieran gets overexcited, swears, then apologises to you, then completely ignores you anyway and keeps going?
I have never had to apologise to the BBC or any other organisation for my behaviour.
I've seen you regularly apologising to Rachel.
Yes, it's
for
exactly
10 years.
It is exactly like on stage activity, that well spotted. Isn't it, Kieran?
Yeah.
When was your very first ATS in London? Which
where?
When?
Oh, when? That's actually good segue into us being able to plug 10th year of ATS London this
year. There you
year.
Go.
10 years.
Yeah.
10 years.
Congratulations.
Ten years.
Thanks. I think sometimes Kieran feels like it's a sentence, but. Yeah. I'm enthusiastic about it.
Well, look, I've been a fan from the beginning. Wherever I've been in the world, particularly London, obviously. And
are you coming to the?
I don't know, when is it? I only just found out. You just announced it. Oh, right.
September the 9th.
Are you here for Mexico?
Unfortunately not.
Okay.
But obviously, I'm sure with your enormous budget, you can fly in special guests.
Any sponsors out there that want to fly in, JJ?
I was going to say, that might call for some podcast sponsorship. Yeah. Right, moving right along.
JJ Fund.
Let's start talking about our news stories for the week. So first news story for the week. Try and contain yourself there, Kieran. Do you need a Kit Kat?
No, I'm fine. Thank you.
First news story for the week is the ICO's ad tech update report. So they're still in the midst of their investigation into various ad tech practices. This latest update to their report is focusing on real-time bidding and the ICO's views on that and on the ad tech industry's understanding of data protection requirements with regards to RTB. So they have stated that they feel that the ad tech industry has an immature understanding of data protection requirements. Wouldn't be the first time the industry has been called immature, I should say. But they specify a number of practices that they think are risky. So profiling, automated decision making, large scale processing, including of special categories of data, use of innovative technologies, combining and matching data from multiple sources and tracking of geolocation and behaviour, as well as invisible processing. So they sort of group all of those activities together as sort of essential to the RTB process. They do talk about the importance of innovative technology and that it's good that the industry has worked very hard on innovative technology, but they sort of group it all together to state that they feel that the ad tech industry is contravening data protection requirements. So I'm interested to know what you both think about this. Again, early stages of the investigation, but we can't help but imagine what sorts of rulings might come forward towards ad tech companies off the back of this. So let me get your opinions first, and then I might fire off some specific questions. JJ?
So it was interesting because when this news story came out, we were hosting Dennis Buckheim in Australia, and we'd just gone from Melbourne doing an event to Sydney, and the poor chap had that news coming overnight that just made his jet lag a lot worse. And I don't think it was a question of overreacting or any misunderstandings, because there is work in play in the background that I think aligns to what's required in order to respond to this. Because that's effectively what's required, is there has to be an industry response within a certain period of time. Yeah. And obviously that's in relation to the UK, but in terms of best practices and standards, that you need to be consistent, it needs to be global. So again, we lean on Tech Lab for a lot of their insights on this. So if you look at the response to, and first of all, actually, I was wondering, do you know who's actually consulting in, who's providing the specialist advice into this process with the ICO? Do you know?
No.
This is the problem I have with it. I think there's other people at play here.
Yep.
Yeah. So there were some, we've speculated about some people that are potentially involved.
One person in particular.
Exactly.
We won't name his name. It's a bit like Voldemort.
Because we've no evidence.
Oh, shit. We can't.
Did you say Voldemort?
Yeah, I'm not supposed to say his name.
Did you say shit?
Yeah. So not unusual.
So I think I know you're leaning towards, because there are some private individuals that complained directly through to IB Europe, right? And the response from IB Europe I thought was really sensible. So whilst we're going through the evolution of the protocols, and protocols being simply a set of rules and consistency in how one would communicate data between various entities, it's just a set of simple rules. So their analogy was one of a car. You can build a car with the capabilities to break the speed, but you don't build into it the inability to do so. So you build the car, and should someone choose to break the law utilizing the car, it's kind of up to them. If it's deemed required to update the protocols to take into consideration some of the concerns that have been pushed out by the ICO, I think that's one thing. So I think there has to be a response that gets into the detail of what their complaints are, why it's set up in that manner, and what the industry may have to do about it. You can see with the latest release, it's happening. So 3.0, the RTB protocols, is not a big bang release. It's been gradually rolled out. So you've got sellers.json, for instance, and a couple of other standards coming out that increase the level of transparency and simplify a lot of what's going on, with the opportunity for other solutions such as ads.cert in beta that provide a high level of transparency. Then in the background, probably more importantly in relation to identity and privacy, is the work that's happening collaboratively across the industry, including engagement with the browsers where they're willing to engage, in terms of how we manage appropriate consent and management of first party data for advertising in a manner that's conducive with making it work appropriately through the open internet. And so in reality, not too much will change, but there'll have to be a local response here that's a little better informed, and no doubt that will involve product experts from both across the industry but also tech lab.
And I'm interested to know whether you think, you know, what the position in Australia will be, whether you think that there's going to be some specific sort of fallout geared towards that marketplace. What's happening in Australia in general? In prep for this, we spoke briefly about the ACCC's reports, which are, focused a little more broadly. So what's your perspective on that?
So the final version of that report that will come out with some expectations, probably one would imagine, along with some deadlines, is fairly imminent in Australia. In fact, one would expect it in the next few weeks. It's really focused in two areas. One, specifically around competition and major platforms, the future of premium quality, traditional publishing, as it were, in Australia, which is very much in the DNA of that that region, but sort of that the media culture, that's incredibly important with the huge publishers involved. But secondly, around consumer privacy. So once that drops, and it's been a long, detailed process, there's been a lot of information that's been pushed out as a result of what was a very public comment process. You can go and view it, and you'll get commentary from everyone. I mean, pretty much all of our members were commenting in that first phase, along with just random members of the public. So some of the input is fairly amazing as a result. We, as an industry body in Australia, didn't participate in the initial phase of it because we have such a broad membership that were responding themselves. It wasn't for us to have a direct input. But now, since where there's been some specialist consultation required in various areas, that's something we've got a little more involved in. And it's no more detail than you'd find as a member in terms of the standards and guidelines and details that we offer our members, along with a little bit of specialist product support from TechLab.
Yep. Kieron?
So
back to the ICO's report?
I just find it's massively confusing. You have a lot of individual data protection agencies with their own interpretation of a directive that has got it's totally subjective.
You're referring to GDPR.
Yes, and we were in a bit of a bind here because nobody really knows what's going on. And the ICO's report here is including like contextual targeting, which is utter nonsense because that's how Google targets its search ads. So, I mean, where does this stop? Do you know what I mean? Like, certain people have certain objectives to push this as far as them because they have business objectives, right? And I'd like that to be obvious. Certain individuals have business that will benefit from this.
The ICO bringing a ruling forward.
Well, the ICO is irrelevant because the e-privacy directive is coming in next year, which means that opt-in will be basically the standard, right? You need to opt in for data to be used. That's the standard. So we as an industry need to move that way, right? Forget about this half-arsed solution because it won't work because the law that's coming out in Europe, and I don't know if that's going to relate to the UK because obviously with Brexit, who knows where the EU or the UK will go in terms of their own legislation.
Well, now we've brought up Brexit.
Yeah. But it is a good point, right? Legislation could be different here, but I would say it would still stay true to the European law because they don't want to have anything too different because they've got to work across Europe, right?
And currently, data protection laws here in the UK mimic the European laws
And rightly they should do because we need to have some kind of standard across all of Europe. But look, we are heading into a cookieless world, right? Where opt-in is the way to go, right? I can see a future where it's contextual or it's opt-in, right? So we as an industry, and you know, the IAB Tech Lab is doing a fantastic job with engaging with the various data privacy organizations and trying to build a solution that works within the current framework. But the reality is we are moving beyond the cookie, right? That is going away, whether it's e-privacy or whether it's the ITP move, right? Google, Apple, Firefox. That is reality, and we have to kind of move beyond this. And while I can see a lot of people pulling their hair out about this, this is just the reality of the situation.
Right.
So as an industry, we need to figure out ways to be privacy compliant, right, within the law, and then still be able to do what we used to do, right? So whether or not our measurement changes, like as Bauer suggested on stage in Singapore, that we have almost like a panel-based measurement where you have a few people paid to opt in and then map
profiles
around that. We have actual opt-ins, so free walls, all the rest of it, so we can do the same shit as Facebook and Google because we said it before, Facebook's strength as a business is based on logged in users, right? It's not about the context of their inventory because it's dog shit. It's the ability for them to match email with email from marketers and being able to do that type of like frequency capping and targeting and granular targeting. We as the 20%ers don't have that, but we need to have that.
But isn't this the opportunity to collaboratively approach it in a manner that comes up with a solution that works for everyone?
Yes.
You could even make it attractive enough for those within the walled gardens to consider joining the party.
And think about it this way, right? Facebook, Google, and Amazon cannot play in the outside web unless they have a solution as well, right? Mm. So look at Facebook as a good example. The growth they've had so Instagram's been an absolute runaway success for them, right? But they've tapped out mostly on the inventory on Facebook.com, right? So they're looking at new revenue streams like Libra and all the rest of it. But where their real ad growth is around is Facebook Ad Network, which relies on the open web. Likewise, Amazon, right, they have ambitions to take their sales data and be able to target and be across the web. They still need to be able to do that. As does Google. Google obviously need to be able to do that with AdSense and AdX and all the rest of it, right? Google might have an opportunity around their first party brands, but they'll still be blocked in Safari. So this is like, I keep saying it's not a them and us situation. It's actually collective. Yep. Now, if we could all figure out one single ID, like a browser ID that we all can use, right, in a privacy compliant way, it would help the industry massively. I think there's too much energy being spent on trying to figure out a framework around cookies, which I think is going to be defunct in 12 months' time. It's a waste of our time. I know that's not me poo-pooing on the IAB Tech Lab because they're only doing what their members are trying to push them to do.
Like, whatever the identifier is, the cookie just happens to be a very practical, lightweight. I mean, it's a genius little solution.
Of course it is, but it means third-party cookies have been blocked.
Yep. So we know that's coming. So the management of a number, potentially the number of universal IDs, which is almost doesn't exactly make sense to have a number of them, but it feels like it's going that way with the consortium and obviously Digitrust willing to work together. You've got independents like ID5 and the work that's being done by the trade desk, that's basically just their targeting pixel, which they've dispensed across the internet. If there's a way of managing the consent and passing of information between those that can keep both regulators and everyone happy, then you'd hope for a collaborative approach that even the browsers, even the ones that are very anti, that seem to want to block everything or want to be able to create their own ecosystems, or the likes of Brave that are off in a different direction.
Well, they're a bunch of crackpots. Let's not mention them again. And obviously, they're what I would call them is, they used to be Israeli ad networks that used to kind of inject ads. They're an ad injection ad network. It's just hilarious that they've come up with another ad network. Like, yeah, we'll just sell our inventory, we'll be middleman, whatever.
But to what extent, I think I asked Dennis this when we were having a podcast chat after ATS Madrid, to what extent are the other browsers, the more dominant browsers or the more popular browsers, getting involved in these discussions?
So there's a meeting last week between pretty much everyone in ad tech and big publishing in New York, along with, and my understanding is, a couple of the major browsers are involved and a couple aren't.
Okay.
That would be Apple probably saying no.
And then you've got Edge, Microsoft and Chrome being fairly open to what the industry wants to propose to make it workable.
Yeah.
That both protects consumers and enables the industry to do everything that we want to do.
But,
you know, we've gone too far. We know that in terms of the audience targeting over context. I mean, I remember, you know, set up an ad network around here over 10 years ago focused on business and finance, and we felt that we had a unique proposition in terms of quality premium environments and putting together these niche valuable little audiences, and suddenly the idea of a £25 CPM buy wasn't required because those audiences could be found elsewhere for £3, regardless of context and the content that those ads might be adjacent to and all the other brand safety concerns that arose. And it felt significant, and it's been ever thus throughout. So again, a bit of a happy clappy view, but if there is a collaborative approach to the technical considerations and we do focus back again in terms of context and premium and businesses that are prepared to make the effort to have a proper responsible relationship with consumers, manage the first party data appropriately and be able to transact in a, I suppose you'd call it, a second party manner, that does feel like an exciting future to get into. We just need to be able to figure it out.
Yeah, for sure. And also, I just want to draw this back to you know, the consumer's perspective for a moment, because that's one of the reasons why I asked about that ACCC report as well. Like you said, focused somewhat on anti-competition, but also on consumer privacy, really putting the consumer at the heart of their sort of findings and recommendations. And that's what this ought to be about, right? Mm-hmm. We need to be building a slightly better internet from a consumer or user experience. And I think we've said this before, certainly we've said it on the podcast before, you know, at the moment, sort of less targeted advertising actually doesn't mean that you're sort of free from ad clutter. It just means that you're receiving less relevant advertising, and arguably that's more irritating. So can we not move to a world where we can find some technology solutions that mean that advertising can still exist, but exist in a much less intrusive environment, and also where we can better articulate the value exchange for that on behalf of publishers and content providers that need that to continue to monetize their businesses?
Is ad choices. It has been from the beginning, and it always felt like that was underliving its life in Australia, I'll admit, in the last, well, actually 10 years. It's a 10-year-old project in terms of being able to make consumers aware through whatever mechanism, whether it's a prompter on a site, and educate them further and inform them in terms of what's actually happened, and then empower and enable them to set and choose the experiences that each individual wants to have. And that actually remains at the core of what ad choices was all about. The problem is that it's fairly fractured and fragmented, a bit like everything else. When you go there, you got to opt out of various different things, and it's fairly confusing. So that, for me, feels again like an opportunity that would be the consumer-facing proposition through which we can try and manage the controls from the consumer's perspective.
The good thing about this is, I'm pretty confident that we will come up with solutions. I just think the cookie's dead, right? Let's forget about the cookie, but I think we're going to come up with some really, really good solutions that really does empower context-rich publishers, right? For me, the biggest problem I have with the current situation is it's not the cookie matching thing. That's important, I guess, for RTB, right? Well, really, what I'd fear is where publishers can make a ton of money off video and really, really excellent creatives. Reach and frequency is really important to them, right? Because that's important. Now, we need to figure out a way to make them able to do that, the way that Facebook and Google do that, because you're able to show so many ads to Google users, so many ads to Facebook. But in the current 20% of the world where the cookie's going out of fashion, it becomes increasingly harder to do reach and frequency, right? So we need to, this is the great thing about ad tech. I believe we'll start seeing new companies, particularly around measurement, using maybe Dr. Boris's solution around the panel-based stuff that could help with that, right? And then we're going to see money shift then to the bigger sites. Smaller sites, mid-sized sites are going to struggle a little bit because I think they got a lot of traction from the long tail buying, which, you know, Jonas was talking about. It was in the sense that money shifted from the £25 CPM premium sites to these smaller sites because you can retarget those audiences better. We'll see a shift, money come back that way. But we'll go back to a contextual world. I think things will not, it won't fall apart. We'll find a way. But I just think we're in this kind of muddy middle ground at the minute. This bog, we're just kind of wading through it until we get to, yes. You know.
Well, it's a bit of a quagmire of potential initiatives and legislation.
And there's people taking advantage as well in the situation.
There's certainly people taking advantage of it. But, I mean, it does feel like you can't turn sideways at the moment in advertising and marketing without bumping into some kind of proposed regulation or proposed set of controls.
I think the best way to approach the ICO is not to kind of like, say you're a bunch of, you know nothing. It's to engage them. Yeah. Sit down with them.
Of course, be proactive.
With not only the IAB, but some of the bigger players and say, look, we agree with you, right? And rightly so. This should be about the user. It has been about, this story has been about the user and user privacy and control over data. And it should be going forward. But we're not going to a world where we have just 1,000 walled gardens. It would be a disaster. And I feel that's just not going to help premium publishers.
And
anyway,
it's a federated approach that you have both in Europe and actually in the US as well, right? What's happening there on a state-by-state basis is inconsistent. And what you have here is a different approach from the French are doing one thing, the Brits, everywhere else. So there needs to be a consistent response that is global, because standards need to work in that manner, but is conducive and appropriate for all markets.
I think the opt-in is the way to go. A hard opt-in. Anyway, let's move on to the next story.
Sorry, Kieran, who's moderating this session? You see, JJ, see what I've got to deal with?
I think you need to move on. Is that a yellow card?
Definitely a yellow card.
It's a black card in Gaelic football. That's a sent off.
Let's move on to the next story, shall we?
Yeah.
What a surprise. So, a report released from a research company called Juniper Research earlier on this week on digital ad spend and how much it's set to increase by up to 2023. So in the US, it's set to reach $520 billion, or roughly 410 billion sterling. And Amazon's revenue share within that is set to grow significantly. So they currently hold a 3% market share of the advertising marketplace, and it's set to increase up to 8%.
In the US or globally?
In the US.
Right, because Amazon's not really doing that much here.
No, in the US. And at the same time, this research report points to Google's share of global advertising spend reducing by about 1%. So what's interesting about this is that one's got to ask where that share of the advertising pie is coming from. If Google's share is only going to reduce 1%, and that's globally, where's Amazon's 8% increase in the US going to be coming from? Is it going to be coming from outside of the walled gardens and other independent ad tech players? And also, I'm interested to know what this says about Amazon's sort of ambitions to grow outside of the US, because we know, you know, that they're very sort of proactive in growing their advertising business in other markets. We've obviously just spent a couple of weeks in Singapore talking about all things APAC, and we know that they're looking to be hugely acquisitive over in APAC as well, yet they've got some stiff competition from other Asian tech platforms. So what's your perspective on this? JJ, let's go to you first.
So Amazon, obviously, fairly fascinating. They've been a sleeping giant for a long time. They've rather stealthily and quietly and competently hired very good people very recently in Australia. and are gradually setting up a team under someone that's coming back from the States actually to run them in Oz. And it's, you know, I mean, you look at the, I mean, you say they're not doing anything, but they are pushed, they've been pushing out a wrapper for a while. My understanding is everywhere, and part of, and I and now this is a personal view, by the way, I'd imagine that part of that is to ensure that, along with the huge base continuously authenticating users that they have access to directly, is to build out a network of addressable audiences everywhere. So as part of the relationship in relation to the wrapper, my understanding is that, or my assumption would be, there'll be a quid pro quo in terms of accessing those users directly for Amazon once they're up and running. They're in the process of acquiring established technology, which we know. And the combination of those two approaches does make it very interesting. If you're asking where the money would come from, the bit that often is forgotten is that most of the money in the big platforms are long to mid-tier. It's small businesses and individuals that chuck a bit into search, they chuck a bit into Facebook because it's easy and you know, fairly effective for their requirements. They may spread out through the open internet via whatever GDN's called these days, etc. And this could be another direct tool for them to hit the audiences in appropriate context and environments that's happy for them. So if there's money that will shift, that's a shift that we'll see away from current bigger players where it's simple, and that is significant. People often forget about it. And then everyone screams and shouts about the big brands in terms of where their spend goes. And you'd hope that addressability via Amazon's audiences is happening across the open internet, and you want to see the budgets flow in that manner it's subjective, but what one would call quality environments and support quality publishing.
Yep. Kieran, what about you? Where do you think that growth in Amazon's share of the pie is going to come from?
So I agree with Jonas. I think that the power that both Facebook and Google has in terms of growth is coming from that mid to long tail, right? Okay, they're getting some spend from the top 1,000 brands, like the top big FMCGs and the big brands. But the power they have, the power behind their growth is definitely from the mid to long tail, right? So you look at Amazon, one of the big trends at the minute is it's really interesting. I'm surprised there's not more companies like it. There's a company called Acorn Eye, Ross Carvel, he used to be at Microsoft and went to Amazon for a couple of years, but he obviously spotted a big trend there for delivering ads on Amazon to push an outcome, a sale, right? The platform's huge, and particularly in the DTC world, it's the go-to transactional layer, right, for most DTC brands. So there's a huge opportunity to buy ads on Amazon and to basically, to grow their business. So I think that 8% growth is not coming from traditional, like the network effect that you were talking about.
Big brands.
It's actually coming from their own internal sales. Like, so, you know, where that budget's coming from, some's coming from Google, some of it's new. Maybe it's a spend that was going to local press or local radio or whatever. So a lot of local brands see, you know, Amazon as a global platform, and you can sell more stuff in it. So, you know, I'm only talking from people I spoke to in my own sort of sphere who've been using it as a means to push,
to sell things.
Sell things, yeah. There's also the in-store purchases, marketing budgets, like, you know, where stores, traditional
in-store promotions,
in-store promotions,
shopper budgets,
a ton of money. And I was always wondering about this the last couple of years, because I asked people, those retail stores get so much money from marketing. Well, why would you spend it in those stores now when your customer is on Amazon or Alibaba? So, you know, I'm surprised Alibaba's number's not here, because I think that's another platform that could do very well here. But Amazon is just a different beast. It's probably taking money from everywhere, but it's taking money from traditional parts than sort of publisher pots. And I think that Jonas made a good point that they're really active in aggregating content, particularly inventory, particularly with mid to long tail publishers and bigger publishers where they've deployed their wrapper. So that money is coming out as well. So they're, this goes back to our previous story, like they still need that mechanism to do that opt-in users to do that across the web. So you're going back to the old, to the chicken and egg. So maybe these numbers are predicated on that situation being figured out. As for Google's decrease, if the market's growing that big, a 1% decrease isn't really going to help. You know, it's decelerating.
It's not going to make a difference.
No, they're still making more money than anybody else. Like, you know, but clearly they are probably tapping out on how much more money they can take from the ecosystem. So they're going to have to, you know, they've been going really aggressive in the whole shopping area. So I wouldn't be surprised if they start trying to go after Amazon's business around building like a transactional layer for their own customers.
So just taking this back to an APAC focus as well, just because I've still got Singapore fresh in my mind, how do you think this is going to play out in Asia for Amazon? Because, you know, if they're perhaps looking to acquire more sellers in a marketplace environment, you could argue that sort of more developing economies is a great place to do that. But then we know that there are some really interesting tech platforms, you know, growing in APAC, not just the likes of Alibaba, Baidu, Tencent, but, you know, the sort of the growth and the rise of super utility apps like Grab and Gojek. So for the uninitiated listeners, these are initially started out as ride hailing platforms. Obviously, Grab bought Uber in, Grab bought Uber in Malaysia and Singapore, Southeast Asia. And Gojek is an Indonesian a platform that started through ride hailing. And they both now provide a plethora of services to their users.
A plethora.
Yes.
Great word.
I think so. Thank you.
I like it.
It's like the Three Amigos. A plethora.
Yes. A cacophony.
Yeah.
Someone's just jealous because they didn't throw it in there. Yeah. Anyway. And so, you know, will Amazon be facing sort of competition from these Asian technology platforms that just organize their business in a completely different way and already have a massive user base and are just set to kind of try to expand as quickly as they possibly can?
Dimensions that one saw at your event. And you know, it's funny being here, I'm almost worried about being in an Aussie bubble. You can when you're over in Australia, because the rise of the super apps, you'd hear about it, but it's not actually in Australia. I don't think I've got one on my phone. I'm not really sure what they are. I'm fairly old and confused, but they sound incredible, and it makes so much sense from a consumer perspective. And it's exciting to see that level of innovation and development that and how the likes of Amazon will try and crack into that, particularly in what is essentially an in-app environment, perpetually. You're perpetually in-app.
I think they'll struggle, though, because it's a mix of social and transactional. I don't think that's not really in Amazon's DNA, right? So, like,
but I think this is what I mean. You could imagine Grab and Gojek setting up their own seller marketplace.
And why not?
Instantly, why not?
I mean, I used the Grab ad in Singapore extensively while I was there, and it's fantastic. There's everything on there. So like you could argue that I guess two worlds collide, and there's no reason why you couldn't have, like, they've got an API, so there's no reason why third party sellers couldn't plug into that app and sell their wares on the app itself. They've actually got like a payment function as well, so that's all covered off. I mean, logistics would be the issue, but even Amazon's messed that up in Asia because it's quite complicated. So, you know, there's one side. I think there's going to be many, many different players globally. Amazon won't have it all their own way. And to be honest, they're in different industries. This is just one area that Amazon's in. I mean, e-commerce is still at the core, but they're involved in everything. Their cloud business is going mental. They've got, you know, they're in pharmaceuticals. They're in retail sales as well, at the consumer sales. So they've got lots of different facets, but certainly it won't be the app that rules them all. There's going to be a lot more players here, and we're going to see spending forecasts are very US centric. The world is very fragmented. There's different players all over, like, and the growth is not in the US over the next 20 years. The growth is in Asia,
without a doubt.
Growth is in Turkey, the Middle East. Those countries are like, their populations are growing, and it's a very young population. Brazil as well. So, you know, the story will be about these new apps, these new platforms, and the Asia super app is really interesting.
It's amazing because it's not mobile first; it's mobile only. And you look
at
the exploding. You know, you think of the growth areas, as we mentioned, South America or places like Nigeria. That's all, and India. Mobile only. Never mind. It's fascinating. It's really exciting.
It is.
ATS Mumbai. We did talk about it.
Boom. It's definitely happening.
Oh, okay. It's definitely happening. Okay, moving on to the third news story of the week. This is a news story about WPP and its irritation with Accenture. So WPP have come out to say that they won't share any media data with Accenture for auditing purposes because the holding group doesn't trust the consultancy, right? So this is Accenture obviously operating their media business. And in fact, I'm a little confused about this, through Accenture Interactive, I presume. And then, of course, Accenture's consulting arm, who amongst which does, you know, a whole range of things, including auditing. And WPP have come out saying that they will not provide media data to Accenture for auditing purposes because of the fact that they run their own media business, whether that's through Accenture Interactive or not. What do you think about this spat? It's pretty interesting, isn't it?
It is, but I mean, if you actually stand back and look at it, it's fairly commonsensical. Whilst you have sort of contractual obligations within a larger business and internal firewalls, WPP would have to mitigate the risk of one of their competitors in a process having access to valuable. I mean, there's enough of a risk there to mitigate without, again, this is a personal view, without making assumptions that any entity would do the wrong thing. You know, it can be a problem. So I see it all the time. Even in Australia with smaller consultancies that come in supposedly giving objective advice about this, that and the other, particularly say going programmatic, and then having a education arm linked to a trading desk. So you're educating a client on something and then ultimately you start the spending through your own desk. There's nothing particularly objective about that, but it may well suit that business's requirements, but it's not necessarily a true consultative approach. The short time I spent with Videology here, which was fantastic, that was sort of 7 or 8 years ago for about 6 months. You know, that was a business that at the time was doing incredibly well, particularly in the UK, but essentially managing buying on behalf of client A, who was competitive with client B. And you had to build out contractual and almost cultural firewalls around each of the teams and what they were doing and what they were saying. But if anyone could pretend you could stop staff going out for a beer and information being swapped, when of course the business is being responsible at how they're managing it day to day, there's still a risk there that the likes of WPP wish to mitigate. So you stand back and look at it, and whilst it might seem controversial, my personal view is that it's
not surprising,
fairly sensible.
Yeah, Kieran,
this is inevitable.
Yeah,
there's a conflict of interest here.
But these aren't conflicts of interest in
This is different.
Usually, I guess this is a different.
Accenture have gone all out. We're in the media buying business. Accenture Interactive is basically a programmatic business, which is a media buying business. So them having access to sensitive information like this means that future pitches they could easy, you know, they could probably outbid or I think WPP interpreting pricing because they have got inside information. And I think WPP are right. And it's interesting that they didn't. I read a couple of articles on this online, and there was one piece around they were given cover by Mars. Mars basically said we can no longer have, you know, an auditor and a media buyer in the same
business.
It has to be one or the other.
But presumably,
and this is the problem with consultancies. This is where they're going to run into problems because their businesses are, you know, they do different things, and then they start to be conflicts going on. And, you know, Accenture have got very, very ambitious targets for Accenture Interactive. They're hiring many people that we know from the agency world to try and get up to the pitch where the holding groups are, right? So at the minute, they're in the pitches, but they're not winning the pitches. So they're hiring the talent in. But what happens when they start winning meaningful business, right? They're gonna have to choose between one or the other. They can't be auditor, and you can't be a player referee. You know what? I'm a centre forward. I'll give myself a penalty. It's nonsense.
Particularly with the board level relationships that a lot of those businesses have, and then if you look at things like in France, you know, the Sapin Law. Whilst that's more financial, you know, that's there for a reason to ensure that you can't have a player and referee situation.
Yeah,
which is interesting.
I mean, you would. I can't imagine that as an auditing firm, Accenture haven't provided some kinds of response to that that says we keep this very separate to our media buying business. But nevertheless, it then comes down to a question of trust and also transparency, understanding how that actually plays plays out on in a real life situation. And as Kieran says, what we know is it's not just from within agencies, but Accenture are hiring across ad tech as well. So, you know, they are being very serious about the efforts that they're putting behind their media buying business. So, like you say, not that surprising that WPP have taken a stand in this instance.
We're not questioning the integrity of
Accenture. No one's being irresponsible.
But as you say, people in the business talk, right? And, you know, over a couple of pints, stuff could come out and then suddenly it becomes part of the pitch. And it's
the insider trading of ad tech.
Well, not really. I think there has to be a red line between execution and auditing. It's common sense. And brands should be wary of that. And, you know, look, Accenture are obviously looking to build revenue in this area and they're looking to go after the holding groups. And I think WPP has had enough, right, to say, look, these guys are now in our turf. We can't tolerate this anymore because we're competitive, right? If you're pitching, like Accenture are aggressively pitching for every big or in every big RFP process right now. They're not winning them. In fact, they're doing pretty poorly. Hence the reason why they're trying to buy half a dozen companies around the world at the minute, right? They're trying to buy talent in to help them win those pitches. Mm. But when they start winning the big pitches, the big Fords, the big FMCGs, big drink brands, you know, that's when things... I think Mars have seen down the road where things are going, like. So they've said, enough's enough.
You're basically looking at the two areas that you provide in terms of real value in those businesses, are human intellectual property and technical capabilities. Mm. And if there's any risk to a business like WPP of the former being eroded in any way and it not being a straight-up opportunity for them, I can fully understand the decision.
And what does it say about the service layer model? Because we talk about this quite a lot. We talk about it a lot at ATS events, mostly because it's always interesting to understand how that's playing out in each individual regional sort of marketplace. But, you know, Accenture are obviously going after this business because they think there's an opportunity there. But where does consultancy start and finish, and where does agency expertise start and finish? Mm. And how are we seeing, you know, this convergence to the extent that the two are actually the same sorts of businesses, or will we see Accenture maybe stand back from this and go, hang on a minute, let's just sort of go back to some of our core capabilities and let's think about the value that we're actually providing to clients here. Should it be in media buying? Should it rather be more, you know, focused on the consultancy piece?
Well, there's no more out-of-the-box solutions. I mean, as businesses mature and evolve, look at ad networks. You had to provide a different ad hoc services for the various opportunities that were available. You had to be able to be flexible and allow almost the clients to cherry-pick as per their requirements. Mm. It's interesting.
It's a complicated ecosystem right now. And as I said on the stage at ATS Singapore, we're going to see modularity, if you will. There'll be different parts of the business covered off by
different players.
So there's going to be an overlap between what WPP does and what Accenture does, right? So maybe WPP has some consultancy piece that they do for a client, and maybe Accenture's doing the execution. One of the things that is core that needs to stand alone is auditing. I just think that auditing gives you a competitive advantage into the pricing and activity of your competitor. And I think WPP are right to do this. And I guarantee all the holding groups will follow suit here now. We'll see publicists make a statement probably in the next couple of weeks, Havas, IPG, because they're facing the same problem. Their clients are being courted by the consultancies. Mm. They all have ambitions to take that away. I mean, like you're talking about, $560 billion digital advertising business in the US. Potentially $1 trillion in globally. You know, that's a market that the consultancies cannot ignore, right?
They want a growth piece of that.
They want a piece of that. But how do they do it?
But they need to think about how they then...
How do you do it is another...
Exactly, they need to think about how they
structure
their offering.
Great people like Casper Slickham and
Nigel Gilbert
and all these guys, and not have a core underneath them. Like, yeah. And not have a backbone to do it.
Deep specialisation and execution.
Because
layers.
You can have all the, you know, the chiefs doing the stuff, but you can have people running, getting their hands dirty to blow them and being able to do a lot of work. I'm not saying that those people are not capable, because those two men are very capable, but you have to have hundreds of thousands of people who can do that as well. And that's what clients are looking for as well. I mean, This is where I think that it gets really messy for consultancies, because they're used to, here's a PowerPoint, I want my 10 grand.
That's what I mean. We talked about this. You know. We talked about this at ACS as well. Is there area of expertise in execution? Not necessarily.
No, it's not.
So that's what I mean. From a business model perspective, are they right to be trying to go into that, or ought they to be standing back thinking, let's think about where our strengths are actually? Particularly since they'll be facing very stiff competition from agencies.
But you want to get into that top consultative managerial layer and then push down the advice to elsewhere. It's just interesting to see whether they build that out in full.
Is that scalable?
What's also really interesting is that if you look at some of the smaller, more independent consultancies, from the conversations I have with the people that run those consultancies, they structure their approach completely differently. And they don't get involved in things that they don't feel they're necessarily experts in.
Yep.
And they make a really good, you know, they've got a really good thriving business by just going in, providing that consultancy expertise when and where it's needed, developing those ongoing relationships with brands and even with agency partners and with tech vendors as well over time to work out where they can add their value and slot themselves in.
There's some very interesting ones that are doing it bottom up, that are highly capable in platform at the coalface and actually have a better opportunity from a strategic perspective than they realise. I deal with quite a lot of that in Melbourne in particular.
Okay.
And the ecosystem is getting more complex, not easier. So, you know, there's going to be new independent players in this space, not just Accenture and the other consultancies. You're going to see people who have specialisation in implementation around data management and data execution and, you know, MarTech sort of integrations. And this is not going to be straight up win for a holding group or a consultancy business. There's going to be smaller independent players who can add real value, and there's going to be tons of opportunity. But the thing is, the consultancy is going to have to figure out what they are and what they do, because they're all about scale, right? It's all about revenue for them and all about billings. And it's sometimes...
Well, I think that's why they've...
Well, that's the problem, because clients don't want to pay procurement. Mm. Procurement don't want to pay, here's £1 million, IBM. Thank you for that wonderful PowerPoint. Now let's figure out who's actually going to do this shit.
Yes.
Because you're not. You're off to your second
to
home.
Your next,
down at, yeah.
To your next project.
Your next
yeah.
locust, you know, filled adventure.
Well, there's a lot of that you see in even bigger businesses with fairly frustrated specialists that sit within them, where their projects and work need to go through some form of diligence. And you have businesses come in and pretty much just tick off the bloody obvious that's already been done. And that's a frustration too. It's an interesting space.
It is. And I feel like the conversations around this with regard to ad tech are just going to keep heating up over the coming months.
Do you know the other thing that's really interesting right now is it's just not the consultancies and holding groups. I could see ad networks starting to move into this space, like middleman execution layers.
Because they're in the position sometimes of providing consultancy advice.
The ability of a middle-tier execution piece, I won't name any names, but you could probably guess a few of them, who could do programmatic TV, who can do programmatic out of home, and can do programmatic, and looking at the DTC guys and going, look, we're data first, right? I think this space gets even more complicated because the type of brands that the consultancies and the holding groups traditionally are servicing are FMCGs and the big brands that we know of, right? But there's a whole new wave of brands coming up, DTC brands,
digitally
right?
Native brands who have completely different requirements.
Completely different respect of the world, right? And requirements. And it's hands off, because those guys who work with the agencies will never touch those brands because they're not aligned to the agencies. And the agencies are going to find it very difficult to recruit those brands because they are way more focused on outcomes, right? Which the agencies aren't, right? The agencies are based on give me your spend and we'll work towards some agreed soft objectives. Whereas these guys are going, I will get you sales. I will get you objectives, right? So
I think that's really interesting.
This service is way more interesting than just consultancy versus the holding groups.
But also, as you say, you get into some pretty heavy conversations pretty quickly. There's a lot of big consumer brands globally that have a massive relationship with people. You look at sporting organisations or even, whether you talk about government, someone I'm meeting later I used to work with looks after a lot of the local councils. They have access to people on an ongoing basis, and there's a digital opportunity there with the right advice for a whole range of, rather than just being more effective in their core purpose, but to also look at things responsibly that could be additional revenue streams. It's interesting.
Absolutely.
Particularly the sporting foundations like you see in Australia and here.
There's
huge opportunity, actually.
There's a lot of opportunity
and
there.
Just a lot of moving parts, I think.
Yeah.
Right. So moving on to the second part of this podcast, a little bit more of a chit chat about what you're up to at the moment, JJ. Tell us about what's occupying you down in Oz and from an IAB perspective, and tell us a little bit about your involvement in Tech Lab too.
Yes. Well, for the last couple of years since being independent, it's been an interesting ride. I've really enjoyed it. One's a little more vulnerable. There's sometimes famine or feast as a consultant. But the one consistent I've had throughout is a portion of my time being dedicated to IAB Australia. For 5 years, as a part of my responsibilities at REA Group, I sat on the board, and that was an experience that I enjoyed. But I often would quite like getting into some of the detail or getting involved in events, etc. So it felt like an immediate opportunity to work with IAB Australia fairly quickly on a very sort of part-time basis, just to help coordinate some of the projects, push out awareness around some of the standards and guidelines, get involved in the councils and events, and just give it a bit more of a nudge at the coalface, which I've really enjoyed. Mm. That responsibility's grown, and I've done more and more of it to the point now where it's the majority of my time, and part of that is an expanded role and responsibility, not only to the to IAB Australia, but also through Tech Lab, because there's so much of the work that's being done that is technical, and how stuff works, as you spent time with Dennis, is really important, right? And increasingly, we've had real success in Australia of just getting groups together on things like VAST or new protocols, or even if there's a bit of a ding-dong around some creative guidelines, which was an interesting one. We had to get everyone in a room, vendors, publishers, creative agencies, and just figure out some compromises on guidelines that we felt were appropriate for the Australian market. And in the end, the support of Tech Lab has always been consistent. So I'm excited by the opportunity to not only concentrate more in that area for IAB Australia, but also to help drive awareness in a similar manner to that we've managed in Australia across APAC.
And are you noticing some differences in how, I suppose, because I was just going to say that the marketplace in Australia is somewhat of a community. Everyone knows each other, which is, I mean, I know that's a bit of a feature of our industry in general, right, wherever you go. But so how have people sort of embraced some of the work that you've been doing through IAB, and particularly some of the Tech Lab stuff that you're setting up? How have they embraced that in Australia? And have you noticed some differences between the approach there to the approach perhaps elsewhere in APAC, or even, I know you've only been here in the UK on holes, I should say.
I am on holiday right now.
Yeah. So I don't expect you to be immersed in IAB Tech Lab stuff while you're on holes, but just chatting with people in the UK and elsewhere, have you noticed some differences?
I'll probably find out a bit more today. I'm going to see the IAB guys this afternoon. In Australia, it's generally about, firstly, communicating the value from a technology perspective into the C-suite and sort of non-technicals. So there's a communication piece there. A Tech Lab don't pretend to be a PR agency. They don't create sales decks. You know, they're a bunch of guys developing, releasing, and managing and supporting technological protocols and standards. So sometimes you just tell the story in a different way, which I suppose I built a career on with my ad operations and tech ops background and becoming more commercial. You kind of realize how to communicate to different people. And so there's an aspect of that. And with the right people in the room that are into it, it's fairly easy. You've got a group of supportive, fans almost of some simple standards like ads.txt and appads.txt. Just getting the momentum there and getting the level of adoption up makes it meaningful. It's not obligatory, but once everyone dives into it, it helps shift and improve trust in the industry. So with having access to the right people, I suppose with some credibility and background and experience has made it work. So we have a few councils with certain responsibilities, as you'd imagine, whether it's standards and guidelines, or we've got a fairly meaty executive technology council that's great, and then dedicated sort of video, mobile, audio. And Gay, who's the boss, and she's wonderful to work with, really looks after the measurement side of things, which is a relief, frankly. but when you've got something like VAST, that's a no-brainer, but will require genuine adoption, sometimes some communication around what's 4.1, what's 4.2, what's CIMID, OMID. It's just the latest VAST standards that we need to adopt, and here's the benefits of it. Getting in with the supply side and vendors, showing that working. Same on the buy side, replicating in audio. Those that are involved, it aligns with what they're doing day to day and improves the business and the industry. So it's I find it exciting generally. I mean, and also you feel like you're the good guys. You're doing something
benevolent, right?
As a non-profit that's helping the industry in areas where it really does need help, and that comes down to technology.
I'm a big fan of IAB Australia in particular, because you guys push out some really good content and really sort of focused on some of the reports and studies that you do, which I just think are hugely needed, and it's great that you're doing that in the market. Tell us about what when you're talking about adoption of some of the standards like ads.txt, adsapp.txt, what's that like on the kind of brand side? So are you working closely with brands? Is that mostly or on the buy side, is it mostly through agencies? And where you are having brands engage with you on that, are they, how sort of bought into that and relevant do they feel? Are they the more bigger sort of high street or consumer brands? Mm-hmm. What's that story look like from your perspective?
So again, the evangelism works best with those that understand the value of it and are very into it and tend to get involved in a very collaborative and excited manner. So that naturally will start with some of the more technically inclined in, say, the trading desks, and might move up to some of those, particularly senior guys actually, responsible for all things programmatic at agencies. They kind of get it too. We have obviously tech vendors involved, and publishers traditionally tend to be very proactive in this area. In terms of brands directly, we have a couple of banks and the likes of Amex involved in various councils, Data Council and also the Executive Technology Council. And that's something that we try to do collaboratively by having, just so you know, a relationship with the AANA, the bodies responsible for brands, and with the MFA, who look after agencies. Last year, we put out some advertising principles together in key areas around trust, data, viewability, brand safety, ad fraud, etc. And that's something we're looking to build on again. And it will become slightly more technical. So naturally, we're starting to engage with more technically inclined members of both the agency body and the brand body. And that's fantastic.
It's really good work.
So again, it's a bit, I suppose, this whole industry the last 20 years has excited me, is the technology aspect of it that I sort of fell into as a kid. And I did a lot of in-platform work for almost 12, 13 years, really. And then the community, the people side of it. So what you've probably also seen is as well as all the work that's done, yes, around the revenue reporting we do, even the consumer reports that we do, the work with Nielsen in terms of audience measurement, as well as all the other standards, is a mentorship program that we pushed out. And that came out from the Executive Technology Council. So you had country leads of ad tech publishers and the odd agencies. Once we were, we put out like an ad tech buying guide, and then we formed a working group for the protocols and all the rest of it, what you'd expect. And then actually the core bit that everyone was most aligned on was, how do we support the next generation of talent in our industry? How do we ensure that there's diversity, both in our own council, but in the industry? And we felt that the best way to do it was voluntary, collaborative mentorship.
And you've just launched that program, did you say? Okay,
yep.
So early days, but uptake is
it's looking
great. Good.
Yeah. We've got 20 mentors currently sort of distributed geographically, 10 females, 10 males. We've looked for, some of the roles, some people have seniority, they're running big agencies. Some are programmatic experts that they're a bit more niche, but we want there to be a nice breadth and depth
of disciplines.
I mean, those are naturally more experienced, so 10 years plus, and old farts like me been around for 20 years. And then you've got the requirement that the mentees, of whom will go for 40 initially, have 5 years or less experience, so we can support them in that manner. And that thus far, what I've seen come through the process we've got, which is a little survey that you fill in off the site, is really exciting. I've noticed they're all from Sydney thus far. I could do with a few more in Melbourne. We've got four or five quality mentors in Melbourne, but yeah, thus far it's really good, and who knows where this will go and how we manage it appropriately.
Awesome. I mean, I think at ExchangeWire we might not say it often, but it's true that we feel really strongly about encouraging the sort of next generation and next wave of talent in the industry. That's partly why, we've got some of the awards that we run at The Wires, which are peer-to-peer nominated and voted.
Brilliant.
Awards. because it's really important that we encourage the professionalism of everyone in the industry. And also, I think it's a way to tackle diversity, to yes. try to make sure that we've got more diverse workforce.
Well, look at the crowd, and at least the event that I saw, a really good blend. And you know, from the very beginning, when you launched 10 years ago, that first event in London, I remember you were in a room with people that felt... spoke the same language. You know, it's exciting to have that communal aspect.
Yeah, but AgTech is a collection of crackpots and wayward people. I mean, there's always been sort of the home of the dispossessed.
The extroverts and the introverts,
yeah.
right?
Yeah, so, it's actually quite a scale.
One side of the room, people are shouting at the other side, they just won't even look at you. And yeah. On the spectrum.
Until they have three beers and all
comes out. And then it's fine.
Yeah, and that's we do that with our events too. So we do 6 monthly, we just call AdOps events. And we, you know, the topics around... There's a lot of first price auction mechanics came up, but also like naming convention frustrations, like some old school ops things. It's quite funny.
But they're still really important things, right? People deal with on a day to day basis, yep. and they need a forum.
Naming conventions
to talk about.
Is a really big one.
It is. Yeah.
Beautiful.
Wish we'd got that right from the beginning. But yeah, it's exciting, and the expanded role is an opportunity to to answer the second question. In terms of the uptake in APAC, it's incredibly new. I mean, it's a fresh thing. We've only lightly engaged with a few sort of likely suspects that we know would get it just to see that the approach is appropriate, involving the local IABs in an appropriate manner, where it should be a collaborative process that aligns.
But it feels to me that is necessary, like given some of the comments in the ATS Singapore panels, particularly around viewability, when we had that lady from Nestle.
Amy Good from Nestle.
And Laura from IAS saying that only 30% of sites in the region put viewability tags on them. They basically the other 70 deliver like a Excel spreadsheet. So there's probably a lot of adoption that needs to be done. A lot of work by the IAB, particularly IAB Tech Lab, because it's seen as a neutral... helpful sort of organization part of the IAB family.
Well, look at the lack of adoption in apps. So you look at something like the Open Measurement SDK, which is an amazing project where you have a group of competitive vendors working together through one open source SDK to deliver viewability solutions initially, but that open measurement approach will increase. So the adoption of that within someone's app allows the buyers then pick and choose whichever vendor they wish to utilize and gives you full access to the audiences they're in. And everyone's, through an open source way, collaboratively improving the product as they go along. So it's good for the vendors, great for the consumers because it's a lighter execution. It works more efficiently, effectively. You don't need to have 5 or 6 SDKs running at any one time. So you'd think in Asia, that's one as an...
It's a winner.
I mean, along with some of the other bits that we've seen, I think we can copy and paste that, just an appropriate bit of education and awareness. But something like the in-app opportunity is huge.
Yeah, in Asia, definitely. Mm. Okay, I think we've run out of time. Thank you very much, Jonas and Kieron. That was very enjoyable. Before
Barbell.
The fire alarm goes off, that is a test.
Right, okay. Thank you very much. It was a pleasure to be here.
Thank you very much. That was really great.
Thank you, Jonas.
That was the MadTech Podcast.